I didn't intend to create a series about dysfunctional families of the Bible. And it was only until I was sitting there this morning I realized I'm starting a series about dysfunctional families on Mother's Day. I just wanted to do a series about Genesis. Some of the best stories in the Bible are in Genesis. So I started looking at my favorite stories and realized these are deeply dysfunctional families. The word Genesis means beginnings. It's the first book of the Bible. It's a collection of stories to explain how it all began, where we came from, who we are, what God is, how humans relate to God, and how life works. The remarkable thing is that these stories still make sense to us today. We still see ourselves in them. Scholars believe that Genesis was packaged, edited, expanded over a long period of time. But let's use 600 BC as the date that it was written. They weren't writing about the world as it was in 600 BC. They were recording stories about the good old days, stories about where it all began. And the stories themselves were already ancient myths. So imagine Bedouins around a campfire thousands of years ago, gazing at the stars, wondering where and who they were. They didn't read or write. Their oral language was limited, but they could tell stories, even if they had to act them out. And they told stories about what they knew. They understood the basic cycles of nature. They could see abundance around them. They had relationships with each other, their families and tribes. And they could feel the love of a higher power. They sensed a presence. But they also saw death and famine and conflict. And they wanted to know why life was so hard. So they told stories to explain it all. The stories in Genesis mostly conclude, it's our fault. God made us, God tries to love us, but we have disobeyed and resisted from the beginning. And they had this nagging feeling that things used to be much better than they were now. That somehow we had lost a home or a garden where everything was beautiful. We had been separated from God by our own mistakes. Genesis is not only about the early human beings, but about the early God. Well, it's about humans' early understanding of God. The whole Bible is about changing concepts of what God is and how we relate to it. But in Genesis, you get to see God grow and change. He wrestles with these human beings he's made. Not far into Genesis, he decides they're all worthless and sends a great flood so he can start over. Adam and Eve were his first failures. They were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. They ate the forbidden fruit and became aware of their nakedness. So there was nothing to do next but have a baby. They had two little boys who grew into men, or maybe they were born grown. It says, now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have produced a man with the help of the Lord. I mean, imagine her surprise. This was the first pregnancy and birth ever. Next, she bore his brother Abel. Cain means possession, as in selfish acquisition. Abel means breath, vapor, steam, nothingness, futility. There's some foreshadowing there. Now, Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. Typically, the firstborn tended the crops, and the second the livestock. At one level, this story is about nomads settling down and starting to farm. It's the dawning of agriculture. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. So one view is that Cain invented sacrifice. It was his way of thanking God. Remember, his parents were in trouble, Adam and Eve had been kicked out of the garden, so maybe Cain was re-engaging God with an offering. Both sons were. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. That's a pout. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." His countenance fell because this was not the way his life was supposed to go. He was the firstborn son. Second sons, like Abel, were always second. They were lowlier. The first son inherited double what the second son did. So I looked up some theories about why God preferred Abel's offering of animals. And there's a lot of speculation about it over the centuries. One theory is that Cain carried the sin of his parents. He was born in sin. Or maybe Abel brought the firstborn perfect animals, and maybe Cain brought the leftovers. Or maybe Cain gave reluctantly. But the best, actually my personal favorite reason, is from George Lamsa, a Syrian Bible scholar, who said, "Middle Easterners love broiled meat. They would always prefer meat to grain and vegetables, and they assumed God would too." Tommy. See? But remember what else God said. Sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you. Maybe God was warning Cain this was a dicey time for him and not to give in to his emotions. But Cain didn't get it. Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him, slew him. Then the Lord came and said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" And Cain said, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" That question is the basis of all ethics. To what extent are we our brother's keeper? We'll come back to that. The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand." First, notice that God shows up in person, just as he did after Adam and Eve ate from the wrong tree. Keep in mind, Genesis was written at a time when Greek gods and goddesses were the primary religion in that region. And they interacted with human beings and had physical forms. So a conversation with a god wasn't unusual, but it was always intense. "Where's your brother Abel?" Was God really asking what Cain had done, or was he accusing him? You see how these stories are not only about humans learning how to be on earth, but this implies God was learning how to be God. God knew Cain had killed Abel, but he seemed genuinely shocked. This free will thing was not turning out well. We can see in this primitive myth a very modern theological question, which is God evolving, learning and growing along with us or through us? A lot of people are uncomfortable with that idea. They want God to be absolute and unchanging. But apparently that's not how it felt to the ancient Hebrews. Whether or not God was shocked, he punished Cain, just as he had Cain's parents a generation earlier. God said, "When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength." That's a terrible curse for a farmer. "You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." And Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and anyone who meets me may kill me." Now, a bright child in Sunday school might ask, "Who's going to kill him? The only people on the earth are..." You were those kids, weren't you? Me too. It's Cain and his parents, Adam and Eve. The same question arises later when Cain finds a wife. The point is, Cain was afraid of being exiled and alone. And listen to what God said. Not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance. And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. The mark of Cain did not brand him as a criminal. It protected him. And we forget that. We often hear the mark of Cain used to mean some kind of stigma. But it was a sign of God's love, even for this sinner. Does it irritate anyone else that God loves everyone so much? I mean, it doesn't matter what they've done or who they are. It doesn't seem to be something we have to earn or deserve. You are just loved, like Cain. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Nod connotes sleep, away from the Lord, living in unawareness. Literally, Nod means land of wandering tribes. But Cain settled down there. He married, he had a son, and built a city. And the next verses list his descendants, musicians, cowboys, metal workers. Now, they were called nomads, but they're cowboys. So, his life was not destroyed by his mistake, even though killing his brother was a big sin. God did not impose the death penalty. He wouldn't even let someone else hurt Cain. And Cain went on to live a worthy life. This is why I love the Old Testament. Deeply flawed and dysfunctional people are used for divine purposes, if only as a cautionary tale. The difficulties in their lives serve us today, whether the stories really happened or not. If you love Greek and Roman mythology, you'll see the parallels between Cain and Abel and Romulus and Remus. They were twin brothers who argued over land. Romulus killed Remus and built the city of Rome on land saturated with his brother's blood. The stories in Genesis are not literal stories. They are legends and myths to tell us who we are. So, what can we learn from this family? In Unity, we look at the Bible metaphysically or symbolically. Every person, place, or thing in a story represents some part of your consciousness. It's a very personalized way to read the Bible. So the way I see Cain or Abel showing up in me might not be the same for you. But Cain did a couple things I think are familiar to most of us. He let his feelings run away with him. He was feeling anger, jealousy, rejection, and he reacted violently. We've all done that. Maybe not physical murder, but have you ever attacked someone with words because you were angry with them? Or punished them with silence? Or withheld something they wanted? Those are all forms of violence. When we don't turn it outward on others, we turn it inward on ourselves. And Cain seemed to do that too. He was comparing himself to his brother. God liked Abel better. Cain must have been wondering, what's he got that I haven't got? He's my little brother. He's a second son. What about me? Comparison never pays off because it's never accurate. Each of us comes to earth with a divine purpose, and they're different. No one can get your good. It's only yours. No one can get ahead of you on the path because it's only your path, and they have theirs. But Cain acted out of his pain. He wanted someone else to be hurting. He tried to change outer circumstances to make himself feel better. If Abel weren't there, Cain would feel better. Those are primitive emotions to be dealing with. But probably all of us have a little Cain within. It's what makes news. Crimes of passion, jealous lovers, gang wars, global wars, terrorists blowing things up. As humans, we are prone to violent emotion. And maybe that's why God said to Cain, this new human, sin is lurking at your door. You must master it. And who is Abel in us? Is he a victim? Is he the part of us that rolls over and plays dead while the other part is raging? I had to think about this a long time. But I see Abel as pure innocence. What he represents is very much like the Christ child. Remember at Christmas, we talk about the baby Jesus as a symbol of this new, fragile consciousness born in us as we begin to realize our own divinity. It has to be protected and nurtured because it will be threatened by forces that don't want it to live. In the Christmas story, it's Herod killing babies. In our consciousness, it's the ego that fears change, fears that it will die if this new way of living takes over. So it fights back. Have you ever noticed when you declare you're going to improve your life and start something new, all hell breaks loose? Abel is that divine awareness. He's that divine spark that can easily be extinguished by our own human excesses unless we protect it and give it a chance to catch fire. So Cain lost control of his emotions. He compared himself unfavorably. He acted out of his pain, and he ran roughshod over Abel, the pure and innocent divine spark in us. But the big moment in the story is when God says to Cain, "Where's your brother?" And Cain says, "How would I know? Am I my brother's keeper?" The term brother's keeper is everywhere. Google it. It's been the title of many movies and many ministries. The White House started a program last year called My Brother's Keeper for young men of color to mentor and support them as they grow up. So far in Texas, it's been adopted in Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, and a couple of border cities. Keeper can mean defender and protector or master and overseer. But either way, Cain was arguing with God, "I am not the boss of Abel." Today we use brother's keeper in the context of helping each other. But to what extent are we really responsible for each other and what happens on the earth? If we each have our own soul path, if we each have our own consciousness, if we're each the creator of our own experience, what can we really do for each other? God did not answer Cain directly, but the rest of the Bible does. Exodus and Leviticus have laws about caring for strangers and foreigners. The prophets called for justice. Jesus told us to love our neighbors and our enemies. Even Revelation describes the ultimate kingdom of heaven as peace and fairness on earth. So, yes, we are called over and over to love and serve each other. And service can be many things. It doesn't have to be a soup kitchen. Are we willing to release some of our self-absorption and notice other people we might be able to help? That's especially an important question for unity, which does not have a tradition of service. In the first 100 years, unity was all about the inner spiritual path and individual communion with God. Its outreach was teaching and publishing, prayer and healing. And those are worthy endeavors. She's okay. Back here. Teaching and healing are worthy endeavors, but we have not typically been the ones who show up after a tornado hits. In the last 25 years or so, Unity churches have become more attuned to what we can do for others and what we have to offer. This church participates in some community activities. I think we're actually better known for giving so much money around this area, like sharing the proceeds of our Howling Moon fundraiser with Operation Good Shepherd to serve those in need. Being your brother's keeper is about clearing space in your heart for others. What you need to do then will become obvious and you will be inspired to take action. And you don't have to be a special person to do it. Remember the mark of Cain. It was God's blessing even on a murderer. We're all loved inordinately. And most of God's love for humanity has to be expressed through humans on the earth. So yes, I am my brother's keeper. God has no hands and feet but ours. I think the word we want is compassion. It's easy to have compassion for hungry children and Syrian refugees. It might be less easy to have compassion for your brother when he gets something you wanted, represented in this story by God's favor. It's harder to have compassion when you're feeling anger or jealousy or shame, as Cain did. But here's the good thing about those feelings. They let us know how we're doing. The same way physical pain lets us know something's wrong with our bodies. So if you're feeling mired in anger, jealousy, or negativity, it's a clear signal you are shut down and unable to receive your good. The remedy is to change your thinking as quickly as you would take your hand off a hot stove. And I know feelings don't always dissipate that fast. But we can take steps toward compassion. And I want to share a compassion exercise. This is short, from Harry Palmer, who founded the Avatar Training. These are 5 affirmations or reminders you can use whenever you're upset with anyone. This is a way not to kill them. Cain could have used these. So see if they work for you. Cherie, the first one. Just like me, this person is seeking some happiness for his or her life. Okay, I'll concede we all want to be happy. The next one. Just like me, this person is trying to avoid suffering in his or her life. That actually explains a lot about others' behavior. The third one is, just like me, this person has known sadness, loneliness, and despair. You feel a little flicker of compassion? Fourth is, just like me, this person is seeking to fulfill his or her needs. Now, their needs may not be the same as mine, which is why their behavior is incomprehensible. Or maybe their needs are the same, and we seem to be in each other's way. But remember, we're here for different purposes. And the last one is, just like me, this person is learning about life. You can use these on someone you're angry with. You can use them on a spouse or a stranger. You can exercise compassion in the grocery line or I-35. They are just like me, trying to get somewhere. Thank you, Cherie. This allows you to be your brother's keeper even when you don't like him. Your brothers and sisters want the same happiness, they want to avoid the same pain, they want to have their needs met, and they're trying to learn how to live as a human being just as you are. There's one more part of this story. After Abel was killed, Adam and Eve had another baby, a boy named Seth. Seth means replacement or substitute. Subtle. But there is something called the divine law, the law of divine compensation. When something you need seems to be lost or killed or taken away, it is replaced by more good, not always in the same form. I'm sure Adam and Eve would tell you nothing could make up for the loss of Abel. But when you see bad things happen to good people or something happens to you, watch for the law of divine compensation. It's the way that gifts come out of tragedy. It's why I keep insisting that any situation can be redeemed for good. We see it all the time. So now you know its name, the law of divine compensation, or Seth for short. Adam was 130 years old when Seth was born. Still young, he lived to be 930. Seth lived to be 912 in Bible years. That's a long run for a dysfunctional family. But God kept coming down to talk to them in person, and he will do the same for you. So let's take these thoughts into meditation with Kit.
So let's begin as we always do in meditation, whether you've been meditating for years or maybe even just moments. We start with the breath to bring our attention to that life force that is in us, through us and as us constantly, whether we acknowledge it or not. And most of the time we don't acknowledge our breath. So let's take a very deep cleansing breath, fully in fully out. And notice how your body just sort of relaxes a little and shifts a little with that, just that little bit of attention. I invite you, if you haven't already, to gently close your eyes. Continue to allow your breath to just find its natural rhythm. And just allow these words that I say to become yours. As I breathe in, I allow in light. And as I breathe out, I release confusion. As I breathe in, I welcome peace. And as I breathe out, I release discord. As I breathe in, I welcome clarity. As I breathe out, I release the need to control. As I breathe in, I allow compassion. As I breathe out, I release resentment. As I breathe in, I accept the power of the divine that is in me. And as I breathe out with that power, I recognize that that power is love. Change the world with one thought. And one thought that becomes one word. That becomes one action. Of acknowledging the oneness. Acknowledging our brothers and our sisters. are here to be in service to love. Because we are love. So breathe in. And sisters in this room, beyond into the community, beyond and beyond. So bring yourself gently back to this space. Wiggle your hands and feet. Present once again. And let's express our gratitude with the Alleluia. Alleluia.